praying to be in a generous mode.
The kindness kind
to share.
CITR 101.9 FM. It's about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, November the 6th. Special guest all the way from the UK is Paul Gravett. Did I get pronounced right?
No, it's Gravett.
Gravett. Mm. But you're English. That sounds French.
I know. Well, my mum never liked the way that the name got mispronounced when she got married, because it can obviously get, it sounds like grovel or grabbit or rabbit or whatever. So she kind of made it more French. And in fact, it is probably French. Because I came across a bottle of wine and a Gravett with an ES on the end.
Would it be Gravet?
A Chateau Gravett. It means a little grove.
A little grove.
One of the meanings it can.
Oh, I guess a grove.
A grave.
A Gravett would be like.
A little grove.
Yeah.
And there's a Chateau de Gravett, which I intend at one point to go and knock and sort of claim my inheritance and move in. So, anyway, who knows if it's French or English, who knows what it is. But it is Gravett. That's the pronunciation.
Now, you've been involved in the comic scene for over 25 years in the UK?
Mm-hmm.
Is that about right? You started out doing tables, helping...
Yeah, the science fiction thing in the early 80s. Yeah, 81, basically, around that time. Yeah.
Popularly mentioned by Mr. Eddie Campbell in the Alex series. Now, what drew you into comics, into this lifelong obsession?
Yeah, that's a tough question. Well, I've never really been disinterested in them. Somehow they've been able to... I've grown with them and they've grown with me. And my interest in them has periodically been kind of widened, broadened, deepened, to the point where I could ever basically lose interest in them. All my friends at school did, of course, because they put away childish things, as it were. But at the point where I would have probably given them up, I discovered underground comics and things like Warren and Creepy and Skywald and all the kind of scary kind of stuff that I wasn't meant to be reading at the age of about sort of 14 or so. And every so often, things will come along. I was there at the wrong age, really, in a sense, for things like 2000 AD in 77, or for that matter, manga now in the last 10 years. It's not necessarily all aimed at me, but every time these new cultures sort of emerge and spread out, especially in the English language market, it keeps me fascinated. It's been also a huge plus, of course, of the fact that I can read French. That's a fantastic benefit. So following that scene, of course, is incredible. It's gone literally from year to year and got better and better.
It's quite incredible, the wealth of goodness. I just wish more of them spoke English.
Yeah.
I contact some of them for interviews, and some of them, they're okay with the English a little bit, but they almost all would rather just do an interview in French.
Yeah, but they'll make the effort. I mean, we've had several guests over, like Jean-Christophe Menu and Trondheim and David B, and the majority of them will do actually very well in English.
Mm-hmm.
So they'll accommodate.
We have a Trondheim we're sitting on that I'm waiting to be translated before I post it, that we actually hired someone do in French.
Oh, right.
Which would be interesting to a select few, but I think some people will find some enjoyment in it.
Apparently he was in Frankfurt at the book festival this year, but I think there he was doing an interview in English, I think. I believe so. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now...
go ahead.
Well, what are some of the early things that you started doing in comics, other than the helping folks sell stuff?
Well, the reason for starting the whole scene of getting people together was simply because everyone was being pestered silly by people with their photocopied zines, for better or worse, and some of them were actually quite good, in fact, at these bi-monthly comic marts at the Central Hall, Westminster, literally just over the road from the Houses of Parliament and Westminster Abbey in London. These are a very important meeting place for people into comics, not just buying them, but creating them. But there was no kind of focus, no place to put these people's stuff. And so I said, why don't we get a table together and let's bring it all together and give people space to sell from. And it was, I mean, to be honest with you, it was a way also to meet people. And I actually was, probably at that point, maybe losing a bit of interest in sort of mainstream comics and wondering what else was going on. And then, of course, discovered the small press scene and discovered amazing stuff was happening. I had friends when I was at school who... went on, for example, to art college and were doing their own magazines, people like Phil Elliott and Ian Weechreck, and through them we made contact with Eddie Campbell, who was living down in Southend-on-Sea, just down the road from us, and were knocked out by what he was doing in an APA zine, a small circulation, you know, a private magazine, as it were, doing incredible kind of low-key, realistic, quite poetic, lyrical, everyday life kind of stories that we hadn't seen in comics very much before. And this is all around the time as well that you've got things like Raw appearing, which was, of course, an extraordinary thing to suddenly find in Forbidden Planet or Start the War in GoldenEye, just sort of like this big, arty, lavish, extraordinary, strange comic. And I can remember being knocked out so much by Raw and writing to Spiegelman at the time, because at that point I was just sort of plunging into bande dessinée in a very serious way. Shortly around that time, I went over to France the first time with a serious mission to kind of come back with lots of bande dessinée. And I was buying a magazine coming out at that time called Charlie Mensuel, which was an amazingly interesting magazine, edited at the time by Willem, who was Dutch, and who worked with Joost Swarto on several of the comics that Fantagraphics are currently compiling into a best-of collection.
Is that how you pronounce it? Swarta?
It's your Swarta. It just means Joe Black. It sounds pretty exotic. It just means, you know, Joost Swarty or something, but it's Joost, I think it's Joost Swarta. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. But he would, and so, but Charlie Mensuel somehow made it to a French bookshop I'd found in London, and it was just the most amazing experimental avant-garde stuff appearing there. And that was, in many ways, some of the first time I saw things before Raw that were that kind of unusual and coming particularly from France, of course. So I knew what to look out for, and I can remember being precocious and writing to Spiegelman after Raw 1 came out, saying, well, how about these people, how about suggesting people he could publish from France that I'd kind of come back with. I remember I came out with so many bande dessinée albums that I could barely walk. I should have got a taxi. I couldn't walk back home. I was living up with my parents' horse at the time. I couldn't walk back from the station. I'd keep stopping every sort of 5 minutes or so to kind of change hands as my arms got longer and longer. But it was a fantastic experience. And in fact, that was my first meeting with quite a few French artists. We happened to be in Paris at the time when the Salon du Livre was on, and I met with people like Ted Benoit and Jacques de Lustau and I think that's the ones I can remember anyway. There were several people from Metal Urnal anyway. You had a modest table really at this big book fair, and I knew about their work of course a bit from heavy metal of course being translated into English. So that was it. That was an amazing time. So that's really what it is. I think I'm not answering terribly succinctly as you probably.
No, it's okay. It's
the whole point. I think is that every sort of throughout my life, stuff comes along which just recharges my enthusiasm for this medium. This medium has never been better than it is now, in terms of the variety that you can read, both sort of classic and the cutting edge new stuff. And it's not going away, is it? It's going to just get better and better.
So as long as the economy doesn't collapse.
Anybody could say, I've had enough of comics. I'm going to go and get into something else. I mean, I can't imagine anyone dropping them, really.
No.
Yeah.
It's I've been collecting. Oh, probably 20 years.
Ah. Uh-huh.
You know, started as a young boy. First read, Velvet Glove when I was about 14 or 15. Same with Mouse and
right.
All sorts of other mature-ish titles. And you know, just
I can't imagine reading something like that when you're as young as that, of course. But I suppose it was the equivalent shock to a system of me, you know, reading early underground stuff and Warren and Eerie and Psycho and all those things when I was about that same age. Yes, those kind of epiphanies that happen continuously, it seems to me. Yeah,
that's quite interesting. Now it's all those artists that I've grown up on have influenced probably a couple generations of cartoonists now. So it's neat to see the development and how that's kind of spread as far as storytelling.
Yeah, another key point that happened to me is that there was a point also where a friend I've lost touch with since, called Joel Eckers, who's a very good animation artist, and anyway, he helped introduce me to the classics. I mean, I wasn't really all that aware of a lot of the American newspaper strip classics, especially, and going right back to, I mean, a little bit about it, but, you know, Nemo, and that, but through to Kniff and Harriman and a great deal. I mean, that was just another extraordinary discovery to have when you think, I'm sort of losing interest in what's happening next in Marvel, DC Comics, and you discover that when you're maybe sort of 18 or 20 or something.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's really... There's a lot to explore, continuing all the time in this field. It's a very exciting time.
The one time
I did kind of get out of comics a little bit was when I was living in America. After I graduated, I went to Cambridge and got a degree, a law degree, which I never qualified at. But when I went across America on a Greyhound bus in '78, having flown over for like sort of on the cheapest airline in the world at the time, Laker Airways, which got people over to America for a tiny amount of money. And I went with a very good friend of mine from Cambridge, and we went across America, stopping off along the way, like in Kansas and Buffalo, I think. And anyway, we eventually got to Albuquerque, New Mexico, where I lived for about a year, year and a half. And at that time, I got a qualification. Well, I think I qualified for doing radio stuff. I put together jingles and programs and things for their KUNM. This is KUNM Albuquerque, which was the University of New Mexico public radio station. And very good station, playing all kinds of free-form music. It was very open and experimental and exciting, and I discovered lots about music. And I've always loved music, too. But that was the one period when perhaps as comics were at a fairly feeble period. It was just the beginnings of things like ElfQuest and Cerebus, mm-hmm. and indie scene, and there was a DC implosion at that time when suddenly everything went a bit up the creek, and I was feeling less than enthusiastic mostly about the American mainstream comics. So that was an interesting point where I kind of almost didn't get interested and wanted to move into radio or something like that. But anyway, I was back from America to the UK soon after. And from there, it never stopped.
When did you start doing the... well, segue into... Because you got three big things right now. First, I want to talk about the Comica, London International Comics Fest, because that's coming up very soon.
Imminently.
So
it actually opens Friday next week, the 14th.
Perfect.
And at the moment, we're still kind of getting it all together. Comica grew out of just a very interesting association. The ICA, I've done things with them before. When we were doing Escape magazine in the 80s, we got involved with an interesting show that they did called Comic Iconoclasm. It was one of these shows, a bit like High and Low, that was done at the done in New York, of course. It shows where they kind of try and mix together the comic art and the fine art and the influences between the two. The trouble with the ICA show, though, was it was very much all the budget went on getting these big, you know, major pieces from Warhol, Lichtenstein, and the modern guys like Kenny Scharf and the rest of them over. And then there was no budget left to do anything with the comics that they were inspired by. They were kind of like an afterthought. And we were, at the time, Peter and Sam and I, we were doing Escape magazine, and we were asked to do a supplement, a sort of catalogue thing, a lighter thing than the main catalogue. And it ended up being a bit of a diatribe, a bit of a rant against the fine art appropriation and kidnapping and trouncing of comics. There were some great articles in there. Ed Pinsent and Savage Pencil and Woodrow Phoenix wrote some really good pieces. And so it was a kind of subversive catalogue, which was given away through the course of the exhibition. And in a way, going back to the ICA, after they'd done that show in 87, they did a few things subsequently, but not much. But in 2002, I got involved with someone there who wanted to do an evening on comics, and we got Dave Gibbons and Dave McKean involved. And then later on, we had a Grant Morrison event, which was amazing, at doing the interview with him, which was, of course, is wild and off the wall. And after that, as it had gone well, somebody within the ICA, a very important guy that deserves a lot of credit, is John Dunning, who used to work at the ICA as their kind of press officer. And he's a huge comics fan. In fact, he's creating a fantastic graphic novel right now called Salem Brownstone, which is going to be one of the big books of next year. He's from South Africa, and he was constantly pestering the director, Philip Dodd, the director of the ICA, which I should say is the Institute of Contemporary Arts. It's on the Mall, so we're just down the road from Buckingham Palace, so we can wave to Phil and Liz when the flag's on the top of the roof, and they pop in every so often. No, I'm joking. But the location's a really good one, and it's a very important place for fine art and cutting edge and experimental art of all kinds, but it's not really accommodated comics that much. But it just began to, and thanks to John Dunning bringing me in and essentially us hammering away at the director, he gave us a chance to do the first Comica Festival in 2003, and we lucked out because at the time there was no budget, virtually no budget at all for it. I mean, the absolute minimum. At the time, the whole building was being renovated. It was a building site, to be honest, and they gave us the run of the gallery space, the one sort of central gallery that wasn't being refurbished. And we put in a great show, a really interesting show of American underground comics and prints, just the physical comics themselves, mm-hmm. and then a wall of what we call potential comics. But essentially, it was inspired very much by the UBAPO, the Ouvrage de Bande Dessinée Potentielle, the whole kind of experimental approach to comics that the French and l'Association had pioneered. And it went down extremely well. They got a tremendous number of public in, they got great reviews, they sold loads of books in the bookshop, and where it would have otherwise just been a dead period completely, because the place was in transition and in refurbishment. And so from there, they said, okay, we'll do it again. Another huge plus was because I knew the people, Anna Marino, who was involved in the Semana Negra Festival in Gijón in northern Spain, which is the most amazing festival of literature and art to do with everything to do with mystery, crime, horror, anything macabre and noir, including comics. She was inviting over that year Chris Ware, Charles Burns, and Joe Sacco. And amazingly, that festival agreed to let us just whisk them over from Spain to London and back mm-hmm. again, so we could have those three major guests for virtually nothing, just the cost of the within Europe flights, and which gave us, of course, an incredible guest list for yeah. the first year.
Well, those three are just some of the most important cartoonists
yeah.
around.
Yeah.
They're up there in the quote-unquote... I don't know. I don't have a term to use for the people.
No, but for example, with Sacco, of course, it gave us a 5 minutes feature on the news on the main news networks, which again, of course, brought lots of people in. So there was a huge buzz around that, and it really got the festival off to an amazing start.
So, what are some of the festivity events for this year?
Okay, well,
because you have, I was looking at the list of events, and it's quite a diverse
Yeah, it's a little bit less diverse probably than last year. I think last year we just went completely over the top because we had such an amazing link with this whole Asia-Europe project that it meant we had lots of people over who, well, people didn't know anything about. I mean, unfortunately, that's one of the things about doing a festival. You could just have superstars everyone's heard of, and then you'd fill every single event. But the fact is that we also want to be leading the people to new creators, people that haven't maybe made the big name yet. So this is a nice mixture because we've got Art Spiegelman and Spain Rodriguez and Gilbert Shelton. I mean, three of the greats of the American underground, all of whom have got new work out, of course, and they're all going to be together. It's going to be the most fascinating reunion.
Yeah.
There'll be some dirty laundry aired. I'm hoping there will be anyway. That'll be interesting.
You're going to get Kim Deitch for those. He'll give you some stories.
Yes. And we have Dave McKean, who, of course, has been someone I've known for a long time, but he's been so productive. This year he's had several new books out, including a fantastic children's book called The Savage, which is breathtaking. And also, I haven't yet seen it, but I've seen it in the shops. He's done a huge 100-pound slip-cased combination autobiography and cookbook of someone called Heston Blumenthal, who may not be known in America or North America particularly, but he's at one of these celebrity TV chefs over here who does everything super scientifically and creates the very best recipes of whatever kind you can imagine, but all with different kinds of scientific stuff and all kinds of extraordinary gadgets and things. And he's done a book with Dave McKean about his life and his cookery technique.
Will this be kind of similar to the layout of the John Cale biography?
I guess it will. Yes, exactly. I think it will be quite a lot like that.
That was beautiful.
The team's there. I'm also really pleased that we're collaborating with the Thought Bubble Festival, which is a new festival began last year. In Leeds, it's part of a Leeds Film Festival, so it has a strong film element, but it has also a whole day convention with major guests like Mark Millar and Alex Maleev in particular coming over from America. Mm-hmm. And working with them, we've collaborated and with Orbital Comics in London to bring Alex down to London, so he's got a London appearance as well as appearing in Leeds. And I'm a huge fan of Alex Maleev's work, especially on Daredevil, so he's a nice kind of mainstream guest to have.
Mm-hmm.
And then we're also working with the French Institute, who are quite committed to promoting Bande dessinée. Each year they've helped us over the last couple of years, and this year we've got Emmanuel Guibert, whose Alan's War has just come out from First Second. I don't know whether you've seen that.
It's gorgeous.
Isn't it amazing?
It's...
Have you seen that? The YouTube or the video?
I haven't seen the
thing with him painting in water. Have you seen that?
No.
Oh, it's incredible.
He's
you see nothing at all, but he's just literally drawing with water on the page, and then drops the ink, and the ink just flows around this kind of these ravines and tributaries of the drawing, and the drawing suddenly forms there on the page. Quite spectacular.
He's one of the most interesting, that whole crowd of the stuff.
Yeah, definitely. And then, in fact, First Second are doing The Photographer next year, and in some senses we were saying, I mean, I was suggesting we could wait till next year and bring him over when he has that one out, but I wanted him out over here now for the festival, but that's going to be another extraordinary breakthrough book, I think.
And The Professor's Daughter is so gorgeous, too. I mean, there's
beautiful,
as well.
Really well done, yeah. And we've also got Ted Benoit coming over, who is one of the greats of the Laline Claire, the Clear Line, Hergé School, alongside people like Yo Suata. And Benoit's got this, he's done a new out, he's been doing new stories of Blake and Mortimer, Kirby Jacobs, incredibly British detective duo. And the first of those has been put into English by Cinebook, and they're bringing him over from Paris, so that should be a special treat too. And the biggest new thing this year definitely is the first ever Comica Symposium, which is at the V&A, and this is an extraordinary development too, because the V&A, since 1990, the Victorian Albert Museum is one of the three or four greatest museums in the world, and within it, a lot of people don't know this, there is a National Art Library, which is again an extraordinary resource, and since 1990 they've been acquiring important collections of comics. They've had archives before, but in 1990 they acquired the Rakoff collection of graphic literature, as it's called, I think, named after Ian Rakoff, who is a very good, very good friend of mine. He worked with film directors like Lindsay Anderson on If, one of the most remarkable sort of radical films of the late 60s. He also worked with Hugh Hudson on Greystoke. He's worked with Robert Altman and John Borman and Stephen Frears and Nick Rogue and you name it. And he's also written the Western episode of The Prisoner TV series, the Patrick McGoohan series. So he's got to come from the most amazing world of film and TV, but he is passionate about comics. And he was able, with a lot of support and a lot of struggle, frankly, he was able to sell a major collection of something like around 17,000 comics, including early newspaper strip pages and even Tijuana Bibles, to the V&A in 1990. And from that point forward, they've been, over the years, gradually acquiring, either by donation or this year again by purchase, more material, because they recognize the importance of comics. It's a very important development to have this in the UK. It's a bit like, I guess, the Library of Congress in America that does have, you know, major holdings and other places of that sort.
I think they just got the Amazing Fantasy 15
Spider-Man
pages. Yeah.
Isn't
not
that, right?
that Steve
that's
Ditko.
That exists at all, isn't it?
Yeah, well, it's not that Steve Ditko had anything to do with it or anything.
Do we know who had that artwork?
I don't recall reading it.
George Lucas or anyone like whoever it might be.
Well, no. So much of that was all stolen. It was
I see, yes.
Like, there's a big thing, like black market comic art of that era. So it's a big fiasco.
Right. That's the one that the V&A haven't really got into. I know that they might, I suppose, but they haven't yet got into collecting the originals. They are collecting the comics. In fact, this year they acquired a further collection from Ian Radcliffe, a collection of pre-code, post-war, of course, romance comic books. American comic books, and there's some amazing material in there. Of course, so much of it is such a window on how women's roles and were expected, that but their portrayals, etc., in that time. And
some great cartooning.
And
some great cartooning. There's
some fantastic
Toth
work,
did some of his best stuff.
Yeah,
at that period.
Genre. It's a very important genre. We really underappreciated for quite a long time. Partly because it was one of the first to try and bring in realism into and sort of more adult subject matter, and of course it had a very broad appeal to it brought women into the readership as well. And so that collection has been acquired this year by the V&A. So we're partly celebrating that. We've got a whole day symposium with some pretty important speakers, including an evening event with Alan Moore and Melinda Gebbe talking about their Lost Girls material. The whole theme of the day is on archetypes versus stereotypes and how these function, how they formed by comics, and mostly American and European. We're not moving into manga too much, but we've got some important guest creators like Percy Simmons, one of the absolute greatest British graphic novelists. Pat Mills, who of course is a fantastic writer, and we've also got Doug Braithwaite, who is the penciler, very talented penciler on Justice, which is an extraordinary series. I've just been reading the series right now, actually. It's amazing what they've done with that. And we've got people like Charles Dierick, who is involved with the Hergé Foundation. He'll be addressing the recent hoo-ha over here about Tintin in the Congo and the racist representations of Africans in that comic.
The none-too-subtle blackfacing.
Yeah. It's resulted in the book actually being withdrawn from sale to kids here. You can only buy it as an adult.
Really?
That was a result of complaints from people about the representations. And we also have Eric Ferney, who's a former director of the Courtauld Institute, which is another remarkable, important gallery in London. And I'd always heard he was into comics, and he is. You meet him, and he's in this world of medieval fine art. But he also is passionate about Dan Dare and Rip Kirby by Alex Raymond, and he knows a lot about it, and it's going to be fascinating to have him involved. So it'll be a really good, interesting day, I'm quite sure of that. And we hope it goes well so we can, you know, do this on an annual basis with the V&A.
One interesting thing about the schedule of events that you have there, it seems like you're trying not to, you know, a lot of comic events, like you look at something like Ape or SPX, it's all very alternative feeling, but no genre is, I guess, ignored.
If anything, that's true, Robin. I mean, if anything, this year we've kind of tilted it slightly so that we've got a little bit more representation, not overwhelming by any means, but of the mainstream of the superhero. Having Alex Maleev, I think, it's a perfect choice.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, that's quite the contrast between him, and that Daredevil run's fantastic. Like, I will speak volumes of how excellent it is, but to have someone like him, and then someone like Art Spiegelman are complete opposites. You'll never see those two hanging out, I doubt, but, you know.
Probably. Well, the only problem with comic, it has to be said, it doesn't all happen over, like, one day or one weekend, and... at the moment, that may change. I mean, the great thing about comic is it's extremely flexible, and we're rethinking it all the time. But the point really is that it covers basically about 10 to 14 days, and we can then slot things in depending on people's schedules. There are a lot of things I want to improve and change about comic. I mean, it is an expensive thing, unfortunately, because the ICA is an arts venue which doesn't have a lot of funding. Mm-hmm. And we don't have a lot of funding for the event itself. It's miraculous these things work out at all. We get funding mostly from the publishers and occasionally from embassies and things like that. But so it's a small festival, and at the moment I'm not quite sure how it will grow. Let's put it that way. How we're going to nurture it further. But it's now in its sixth year. Although in fact it had a kind of fallow year, shall we say? I think in 2004, and we didn't do a lot the second year running. But it's been gaining momentum, and certainly it's on the map, I think, now.
I just love the whole concept of it, because in Vancouver during the summer, we had an art show here called Crazy.
I saw the catalog for that.
But it was so exclusive.
Yeah?
It was sectioned off, very, like, you know, the people that were chosen for the comic part were definitely chosen by Art Spiegelman and a little bit by Seth.
Yeah.
Like, it was very, this is who is in the show, and this reflects those people's tastes. Like, you're not going to see a Jack Kirby page, you know, you're not going to see, there's so many people just not represented. And it didn't branch out how it could have.
No, and obviously they did feature manga and anime, didn't they, in there?
Yeah, and even that wasn't very well represented, because a lot of the manga art wasn't even original.
Yeah.
They had print-ups. It was like...
Yeah, it can be quite hard to get hold of original artwork. I mean, from my experience, it's not all that easy to get hold of that for exhibition purposes. But, yeah, I think the main one that just struck me, basically, is as the fine art world wanting to kind of... Because I think the subline is something like comics and manga and anime and art.
Yeah.
And I think, and it's kind of like saying, yes, art is as cool as all these other things which are cool, of course, without having to try it being cool. There's a certain kind of slight desperation, I think, going on here when the art world wants to be associated with the cool of popular culture, and popular culture doesn't really care very much about that particularly. I mean, it just gets on and is doing its own thing.
Yeah. No, the gallery...
There's always, I think, a problem of what's represented and what's put together. Any kind of show like this is going to be partial and skewed and come from a curator's point of view.
Yeah. Oh, it was pretty interesting, because it really, the gallery, the staffing was trying to get, you know, local comic artists in to do stuff. And
almost as an afterthought, perhaps.
Yeah, and you've got
some Colin Upton's out there, isn't he?
Colin's here. He wasn't very involved in stuff there.
No.
Not out of his own accord.
Heard about a local publisher out your way called... Perovalag.
Yeah, they do little the Hell passports.
Okay, I haven't even looked found them on the website yet. But I just was talking to someone today who's come across them, met them in Amsterdam, and the couple that are behind this. And they mentioned Fiona Spive's done some stuff with them, and
Billy Mavrais. Colin has one.
Colin's done one with him. With them, yeah.
Yeah, and his is pretty good. Little Hell passport. What I was just going to say is that the head curator made a comment about how they're, you know, not using superhero stuff because it really doesn't step up as a media in comparison with the other comic stuff, which actually quite upset a local... one comic artist actually wrote to the paper and did a big diatribe about why that's a problem of attitudes. And I'm trying to remember the name. He just did that Spider-Man Rain comic, Vancouver... Why can't I think of his name? Oh, this will come back to me. This is bugging me. But, so exclusivity,
I think it's a shame. But the point is there's good and bad stuff.
Carrie wherever Andrews.
You look. And I think it's better to have that point of view than just sort of say the entire mainstream is hopeless and should be ignored. I mean, there's good things happening. Try to find the good stuff wherever it is.
Carrie Andrews
all
was...
all kinds of places. I mean, somebody we've got coming over for Comica this year also, which I wanted last year, but she was having a baby, is Lisa Meary. I think that's how you say Meera or Meera. She's the artist on Nemi. I think she's probably known in America as well, but it's kind of spooky goth girl sort of character. It's, you know, in the newspaper strips, she's one of the best of the new newspaper strips, and I'm really pleased to have her coming over because it's a whole other, you know, area of good comics that are reaching people.
There's so much more out there. The name of the person I was trying to remember, Carrie Andrews. There we go.
Oh, yeah.
Very recognizable name, and he actually pulled out of doing events with the gallery because of their on-the-record stance on superhero comics.
Really?
So that's just an example of why it's great to be diverse and have stuff.
Yeah.
Not to throw a little negative note there, but I think that's important for people to kind of know what's going on.
Yeah.
Now, this is going to continue every year until you burn out on it.
I don't know about that.
It looks like a lot of planning.
I have to find some more people to help me do it. We need some more sponsorship. So if someone out there wants to sponsor some of the most wonderful festivals of comics in the UK, get in touch. Because we need more financial help to make it happen. But it is good to work with the ISCA because they are behind it. And they've got a very nice venue because it's, you know, a mixture of two cinemas and a theater and gallery space and studio space, web studio, for example. And so all the different departments can get involved, the education side of it as well. And the only thing, obviously, perhaps that has been obviously geared mostly to the adult. It hasn't been a kind of family or children-orientated festival. But that's something else I'm certainly not close to. I think we'll find ways of branching out and doing more with that. So, but in fact, it's just a little bit flexible. And it's also fun because it isn't just once a year. We can do events throughout the year. So, for example, I'm lining up post-Angoulême, beginning of February next year. Both David Heatley and Adrian Tomine are going to be over here. So they're going to come to London. They're going
fantastic.
To come to London post-Angoulême. They'll probably be completely shattered, I think. But they'll have to recover. And then within a day or two, we'll have them on at the ICA as well. So that's going to be fantastic.
They're both swell folks.
Yeah. I've met Tomine, but I haven't met Heatley yet.
I interviewed Heatley, and it was a fun interview. And Tomine, I've met and interviewed. And he's good in my books.
Yeah. So.
Now, you have two books. We don't have much time left. We've got about 15 minutes left. So let's quickly talk about your two books.
Hmm.
One, the Mammoth Book of Best Crime Comics.
Yes, I want to see the Mammoth Book of Best Mammoth Comics. Definitely. I haven't looked into that yet, but there must be good Mammoth Comics.
I don't think there's a lot of them, but there's got to be some.
There probably are some. But this is a collection that's been around for ages, the Mammoth Book of... They do these gigantic, low-cost compilations of, you know, prose, you know, whether it's detective stories, horror stories, science fiction, you know, it's genre books. And they've branched out into comics first with manga. They've done they came to me, in fact, to do a book of manga, of Japanese, you know, original manga, and I just told them, well, it's a lovely idea, but it's going to be terribly expensive to get all the rights. So rather than do that, they came up with a rather good idea through Ilya, the comic artist and writer Ilya, of editing, putting together a collection of new manga from around the world. Stretching the term, as we know, the word manga no longer means comics from Japan. It can be really comics in a Japanese style, perhaps, not even that, perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
And they've just brought out the third of those. The first one came out in 2006, and they really have gone from strength to strength on that basis. And from there, they said, well, why don't we do some reprint compilations? And they were talking to me about that, and we eventually hit on doing the crime one, Best Crime Comics. And, the previous two were great. They did one on, the first one was on war, second one was on horror, and they had some good stuff, but they also had a fair amount of filler. I mean, good filler, but shall we say, not exceptional. And the problem is the word best. If you just call it the Mammoth Book of horror comics or war comics, if you haven't got the word best, it's not a problem. But if you put the word best in,
it's got to hold up.
Stuff ought to be worth reading. The trouble is trying to fill, getting on for 500 pages with a very tight budget. It's difficult to maintain the high quality. And I said to them, well, we've got to get the best stuff in here, and they ended up giving me a little bit more budget. I've actually still spent more than I should have done on it, but it's hopefully going to reward itself because it's produced, I think, a really, really classy book.
How much of the stuff, because it's a fair amount of old stuff,
yeah,
how much of it was kind of copyright lapsed?
Yeah, my initials are Paul and Donald, PD, so one of my new names is Public Domain Gravatt, because I want to find out what's public domain in this. And one of the brilliant things we found, thanks to my friend in his kitchen, was he told me that the Alex Raymond Dashiell Hammett Secret Agent X9 material is public domain. Can you believe it?
That's one of the bigger pieces in here, isn't it?
That's exactly why. But also, of course, because you want to make sure people got a complete story and a good story, because the trouble is, further on in the run, Hammett's writing began to be tampered with. And that was the point about the book, is that we want to find public domain material, but also we wanted to have name material that would get, especially not just comic name, but we've got, for example, Mickey Spillane in there as well, and Max Allen Collins, of course, with Miss Tree is in there. Some names, in other words, that have got recognition outside of just the comic circle, so good crime writers. There's more stuff I would love to have put in. We particularly wanted to get Raymond Chantry, and then I've got things in mind that we will certainly do if there's ever a chance to do a sequel volume, which I hope there will be. But in the meantime, this works extremely well. And what I was particularly pleased about, of course, is knowing Alan Moore, it was to be able to get his agreement to let us reprint two of his stories, which work just so perfectly as a kind of intro and outro sort of atmosphere,
the bookends,
and setting stories.
Well, and that's the thing is, I've got a pretty extensive Alan Moore collection. I don't think I have Old Gangsters Never Die anywhere, because that was on a record.
On the record, yeah.
I don't have the record.
Ah.
That kind of stuff you don't get in the West Coast of Canada.
Did you have that already then?
No, I don't. That's one of the few I don't. So
yeah,
because
it was reproduced in the George Currie Extraordinary Gentleman book on Moore.
Oh, yeah, I've got that. Yeah,
but
yeah,
it was kind of like, I think, reproduced from the record sleeve, a kind of fold-out postery thing, and it was very badly printed on that, quite honestly.
Mm-hmm.
And fortunately, I managed to track down Lloyd Thatcher, who is just one of these artists who should have had a huge career in comics. I mean, I got to know him when I was working on Pst magazine before Escape, back in around 81, 82, I guess, something like that. And he very kindly did quite a bit of reworking of the artwork, so it's never looked as good as it's looked in the lead story. And it's the perfect opening, because it's set in a kind of sleazy cabaret. It was originally a song written by Alan Moore for the Sinister Ducks with David Jay of Bauhaus fame. And it just is the perfect kind of moody, sort of dark intro to the whole world of the past of gangsters. And then the story we reprint at the back is I keep coming back. It's a kind of coda to From Hell, illustrated by Oscar Zarate.
No, from Hell.
No, it is From Hell. Yeah.
No,
well, it isn't from Hell.
Okay.
But it is a story about the creation of From Hell.
Oh, okay.
And about Alan's psychological state as he's sort of in the head of Jack the Ripper, in the very pub in Spitalfields in London where Jack was picking up his victims, and sort of sensing the vulnerability, the terrible vulnerability of this young woman who is doing a striptease in this very same pub, and how basically that terrible presence and evil is still lurking in our society at the moment. Even possibly he feels it in stirring in himself. So it's a remarkable piece of writing. And it just ends perfectly with this lone woman walking off into the night, which perfectly suits the ending of the book, as you kind of fade back into black at the end of the book. So Peter Stanbury basically came up, of course, as always, as my co-creator and co-author and designer and partner, with some brilliant graphic devices for the book, and I think it makes it very strong.
It's got that good black and white and red that Frank Miller loved to take on from other folks.
Yeah, well, of course, we were hoping at one point to try and get Miller to be involved in some form, maybe get us reprint a Sin City story. Didn't happen, not least for this book. Maybe it'll happen if we do a sequel. But obviously, the part of the theory was that people that like Sin City would want to read maybe some more stuff. And there's only so many Sin City books out there. So this is kind of like, in a way, as I say in the intro to the book, it's kind of like showing you other artists who inspired Miller, or that Miller has inspired in turn, are in there. Everybody from Munoz and Sampaio to Paul Grist, for example, and of course Eisner and many others. Alex Toth, Johnny Craig are in there with some wonderful work, I think.
One of my favorites in there is Tardy.
Yeah, and yeah. I mean, there's not enough of Tardy translated, is there, really?
No.
It's a great shame. He's one of the... I wish Dorian Corkley, by the way, would compile all of those War of the Trenches stories, which they did a few of, and so did Raw, mm-hmm. put them out into one book. It's one of the masterpieces of Von Destiné that should be...
I want to read his Celine.
Pardon?
I want to read the Celine he did.
Oh, yeah.
Was it Turning to the End of the Night, I think?
For some reason, his work is not hardly known at all. Yeah. My other discovery for many people is the work of Gian De Luca, who's this Italian artist. We only ran one short story by him. He's done an extensive amount of work. He's sadly died some years ago now, but there was a huge show of his in Bologna, the festival I went to in April, where I wrote an essay about his amazing Shakespeare adaptations he did. And he's just one of these stylistic innovators that has been sadly hardly known about outside of Italy, and hardly known in Italy itself, really. So to have his work for the first time in English is a real buzz, too.
It's quite neat. It's like a cross between European cartooning with a little bit of a manga influence into his...
Yeah, because you mentioned that. Yes. Yes, there is that there, isn't there?
That line work, the cross-hatching.
Yeah.
The very manga influence of cross-hatching.
That's great stuff.
I got to say, as far as a anthology, it's a success.
Thank you very much.
I'm a I'm a skeptical guy because I've read too many comics, and it's just like, this is a good collection of mostly stuff I don't have. There's probably about three things.
I was at one point in touch with Ed Brubaker because I love his work, of course, mm-hmm. and there's a brilliant story by him, I'm sure you're aware of, drawn by Jason Lutz, called The Fall.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it's fantastic.
I would love to have run that one. But we decided not to because there are plans, although it doesn't seem to have been announced yet, but he had plans to do a color version of it. And I don't know who was going to publish it. Maybe it was done originally, of course, by Dorian Corkley as a little small book.
Yeah.
So that didn't make it into this cut. I would love to get Brubaker in for a future one, and Bendis too, for that matter. I like his work. And we're looking at doing another one if we can, if Mammoth are up for it. They're waiting to see how well this one goes. But it's got some amazing press. One of the most amazing things is it got chosen as the paperback of the week by the Guardian newspaper.
Oh, wow.
And this is like paperback out of all paperbacks.
Yeah.
I mean, all the great sort of new novels and everything that comes out. So a rave review like that doesn't happen very often. So it's got some great press.
It's a good time to be in comics.
Yeah, it is.
Now, the other one I haven't actually seen yet.
Oh,
haven't
you got a copy of that?
No.
They didn't send you one?
I didn't get one, no. But life will go on.
Right.
My girlfriend's probably happier that way.
Oh, yes. Okay.
The wall
you have
of
no
books.
Room, you have no room for more comics?
Oh, there's always room. You know that.
How do you manage? Because I don't know how I'm managing it. I'm sitting here. You wouldn't believe what it's like in here. I know I told you about... I was in the West Wing. Well, I'm afraid we need to build a West Wing because I've got so many books coming in all the time, and it's fabulous. But and this is not just ones I'm buying. Of course, I get sent lots of review copies as well, and it's an amazing time for comics. But I'm in somewhat inundated at times with them.
No, I've got and I've been getting all my comics bound into big hardcover books.
Are you doing that?
Yeah, well, I've got a ridiculous amount of that, and that's like a whole big other...
Well, I guess it's a way of making them easily accessible, isn't it?
And exactly. So someone, say, like Alex Toth, he's got all these little five-page things in this thing full of crap.
Right.
We'll just rip out the five pages and...
you're doing that.
Yeah.
Gosh, this is like... Well, Eddie Campbell does this, of course, famously. He'll just sort of slice through things and keep only a few pages, and it's all pared down to the minimum. And I can't do that very well, I'm afraid, as you probably gather... Peter's always saying, "Why are you keeping this? You can't even read it." And I'm keeping lots of comics that I can't read. I don't care.
They're fantastic.
So this is part of a dangerous obsession. I'm going to have to eventually. I think the V&A. We talked about the V&A acquiring collections. They're going to have to acquire my collection. I think they will need a West Wing for that as well. I think. But sorry, I haven't seen the new book. I mean, it's got an embarrassing title. In North America, because mind you, do you have maybe you have that edition from St. Martin's Press? Do you have that one over there? I guess you do.
We would have the same as it's in the States.
Okay, right, exactly.
And that's the Leather Nun, I think it's called.
Well, the Leather Nun and Other Incredibly Strange Comics is the UK title.
Oh, okay.
The American title was originally going to be Holy Shit, These Suck, The World's Worst Comic Books. And we had to go back to St. Martin's Press and tell them, well, this isn't the book we've actually supplied you. I mean, these aren't the worst. We can find you for the worst. And we're not too sure. The trouble is, these suck. We just thought, I'm sure maybe it does, but maybe we're wrong. We just thought it was a bit too strong.
Yeah.
It sounds much stronger to us in Britain, where it sounds far more offensive than it probably is in America. So they replaced it with holy shit with a star.
Yeah.
So it's such censored. And it's nothing like the books we've done before. Neither of these books this year are. We've done these three sort of over the top, sort of luxurious, large reference books. You know, the manga book, 60s Japanese comics, and then graphic novels, Toys to Change Your Life, or as it was called in America, Everything You Need to Know, which was not the title we wanted. In fact, just a brief dimension, the graphic novels book. The other idea that the American publisher wanted to do on that gorgeous cover by Daniel Clowes would stick a nice big yellow starburst and put on it the 150 best graphic novels ever. And you go, no. So fortunately, they didn't do that. And of course, we also did a book in 2006 called Great British Comics, which is probably might have more of a market in Canada than it did in America. I mean, it was just too British for the American audience, but so we couldn't find an American publisher for it. But it was needed. It was needed just to kind of really celebrate what we've got, I mean, mm-hmm. British comics culture, which is incredible and rich and underappreciated. Anyway, so this new book, Holy Shit, The World's Weirdest Comic Books, is just a little gift book. It's what we call a stocking filler. Do you have them?
Yep, we got the stocking stuffers.
It's intended to be sort of stacked high by the counter for an impulse purchase, and it's just a really neat little size that Peter came up with, a cute little hardback format, which shows 61... just really strange, interesting comics from all over the place, not just from America. Full page, bleed on the right, and then on the left-hand side, opposite, you've got a panel and a quote and a sort of interesting anecdotal background and the story, a bit of insight. And then in our usual obsessive, nutty way, we managed to link all 61 comics to each other through sort of their thematic content. I don't know why we started doing this, but we did it in graphic novels, and it drove us crazy. But it does actually make things very interesting. If you want to follow a particular strange path and read more comics about cows, or what have we got here, hillbillies, or bondage, for example, or nuns, they're all in here, at least twice anyway, so there are links from one to the other. And Liver Nun is, of course, a very... If you know The Underground, it's a very famous cover and a very famous comic. It's one of the absolute great anthologies of with a cover by Dave Sheridan and with contributors like Spain, Rodriguez, who we mentioned, and Crumb and others appearing inside. It's a tremendous anthology title. And, of course, a wonderful, lurid, blasphemous material, which is just what we wanted to show, just to kind of wake people up a bit. And also, and there are several other classics from the Underground, because they are, for most people, incredibly strange. Mm. And the point, of course, is that initially, this is a book obviously not aimed at the comics aficionado, really. It's aimed mostly at the broader audience that is out there that just wants to buy something funny and amusing and will go, whatever is this? This is going to surprise my boyfriend, girlfriend, whatever, dad, grandmother for Christmas if I put it in their stocking. But once you get past the shock value of the titles and the covers, the whole point is that the book does then take you inside and make you realize that maybe there's more going on here than you thought. And certainly putting in a book like Amputee Love, for example, was done, of course, for shock, as the book itself was originally intended to do. It was obviously a shocking title.
And you have Trucker Fags in Denial in there too, don't you?
Pardon?
Trucker Fags and Denials in there.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely a favorite of mine as well, yes. But it was done to shock. But with Amputee Love, for example, you've got a comic there which is an extraordinarily early piece of candid autobiography, because the couple that Reverend Drew, I think they're actually unnamed, but they don't have their second name appear, but they're called Reen and Rich. I think it's the woman Reen who is an amputee. I have no idea where they are now. We'd love to track them down, because they deserve credit for producing an extraordinary book. I think he's British or Canadian. Brent Boats. He's
a Vancouverite.
He's in Vancouver, isn't he?
Here's your trivia for the day. He designed the Ghostbusters logo.
Yes, I think he mentioned it, because I was in touch with Brent. That's right, he mentioned this. And I just wondered if he knew anything about these creators. I was just trying to track down whatever happened to Reen and Rich. And he didn't know anything much about the book, I don't think, hardly. He was just told to do this quite, you know, it's a good, sexy, well-drawn cover. And
you know,
of course it does. Sorry?
You should talk to Patrick Rosencrantz.
Yeah, he's somebody, if anyone, who might know what's happened to these people.
I'll send you his email address.
Well, that would be good. Thank you. But of course, the point is that once you open it, it's not drawn anything like as slickly once you get inside. In fact, it's quite disappointing if you're hoping for sort of anatomical accuracy and maybe some fairly kind of alluring finish to the artwork. It's very, really quite crude, but it has, once you get past that, such an honesty and it's an extraordinary work, extraordinary piece of comics, and just the kind of thing that I think people need to realize is possible. So I'm very pleased to have that. And then alongside it, we've also got just things that I think nobody's hardly noticed before, from completely ridiculous things like the lesbian unicorn issue of Genus magazine, which is niche marketing taken to the extreme, I think, as in the Furry Brigade, who, all power to them, I can't imagine any many people coming up with lesbian unicorns. It's a spectacular, large issue. But of all my favourites in the book, probably one of them would be the Aborigine comics, which I've seen examples of only once in John Ryan's Powder Panel, which is a fabulous history of Australian comics, came out in the late 70s and was, again, another huge window opening on this culture. But this friend of mine was able to send me the scan of the cover of this glorious book called A Book of Picture Stories, a very bland title, but it has these two characters looking at these Aboriginal natives, Aborigines from the Australian outback, mm-hmm. dressed in these extraordinary striped outfits and looking just fantastic. I was showing them, in fact, I was showing these two Brendan McCarthy, you know Brendan McCarthy's mm-hmm. work, a short while ago, and he's aware of these kind of extraordinary figures in Aboriginal art.
Because he's got to have a lot of influence of that with all the swirls and the...
Yeah, exactly. So that's a wonderful example. And sadly, the book is extremely fragile, and it's made up of essentially like Sunday newspaper pages of these stories done by two sisters, Mary and Elizabeth Durack, who were living with Aborigines in the outback and got to know all their stories and drew them as newspaper strip stories back in the 40s. And someone's got to reprint this, because it's just a work of extraordinary power, I think. And then alongside that, I just love the kind of absurd things. Like, for example, one of the ones I discovered was a particularly ridiculous Popeye comic. He did a whole bunch of kind of message comics about careers, but the most inappropriate one definitely is him sitting in a barber's having a fancy haircut and a shave, saying there's nothing like a haircut, I can't do the accent, shave and manicure to make me feel good. I have a heavy date with olive oil tonight, off. This is Popeye. Popeye Vassello does not do manicures, and he should not be the spokesman for a career as a salon, you know, a hairstylist. It's just the most absurd juxtaposition. And in fact, in the comic, it's quite wonderful. It has a flashback. I don't know whether this has been kind of seen in many other Popeye comics, of what Popeye was like as a little boy, and he has extraordinary kind of curly locks. He's taken to a barber's in the comic, in this flashback. And of course, even as a little boy, has a pipe in his mouth. But it's just a very, very odd example of educational comics. So that whole area is rich material. And I think what we've done with this book, I mean, all credit, a lot of credit, definitely is to go to a great many collectors who are out there at the moment already, who've done years of research into these strange byways of comics. I mean, one of the obvious greats of this subject is Scott Shaw with Oddball Comics, and he's mm-hmm. done so much to raise awareness and raise prices for these strange, weird, odd comics that are out there. And fantastic. But what we've done a little bit differently here is we've tried to take it a bit broader than the mainstream, certainly take it away from American comic books. We've gone into the underground, gone into the stuff from, for example, from Europe, from Italy, from Malaysia, for example. We've got the most extraordinary, nightmarish journey into hell, done as a religious comic for kids. So there's a lot of stuff in there which perhaps wouldn't quite sit comfortably on Scott's website. And that's the whole point, is there's oddities all over the place. I'm finding, having done this book, that more and more people are telling me things about strange comics they've heard of, so we're amassing stuff for
a prequel,
which will probably be even stranger than the first one, I think.
I'm sure Paul Karasik has a good collection of oddities that we've never imagined.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of people out there. Ethan Persoff.
Yep.
Do you remember Ethan?
Yeah, he did the pogo stick with Al Columbia.
Right. He's got a wonderful site. I think it's probably mentioned in the back of the... Let me see if I can dig it out here. But he's got the most amazing website where he was showing me this beautiful Indonesian Batman comic. just literally, very simply, www, then .ep for Ethan Persoff, and then .tc, ep.tc. It's the most amazing site. He does a lot of stuff on sort of problem comics, problem, you know, whether it's drugs or VD and this kind of stuff, which we've not done a lot of in this book, we'll probably do in the sequel. The book hopefully will surprise people, even if you're a pretty knowledgeable comics fan. There are going to be things here I guarantee you you've never seen.
Well, I look forward.
Yeah.
I have to cut us off because I'm at the end of my allotted time.
End of your tether.
And not of my tether. No. Nothing okay. Negative like that. I've got someone actually staring through the window wanting this room, so I need to...
Okay.
But thank you so much for joining us, Paul. So you've got
thank you, Robin.
The Mammoth Book of Best Crime Stories, the Holy Shit...
sorry about that title.
Oh, that's okay. Or The Leather Nun, as it's called in the...
Yeah.
In the I guess the motherland.
Yes, the UK. Yes. Obviously, if I could just same shamelessly mention just that if people want to have a look at things, the Paul Gravett website is worth a visit to, just paulgravett.com.
With two T's.
With yes, GRAVETT. Yes.
And I'll have it linked on the Extant website, of course.
Yeah.
And you also, starting next week, have the Comic International Festival.
That's right.
Which I wish I. Could attend that. It looks fabulous.
Well, there'll be quite a lot of stuff. It's going to be podcast. Resonance FM, the radio station, is going to podcast a lot of the talks and things.
Oh, so neat.
There'll be links on the website for that.
Oh, we'll have to check that out. Well, thank you so much, Paul.
Thank you.
And one last favor.
Mm-hmm.
Send me an email with two song requests.
Oh, okay. Lovely, yes.
All right.
I'll do that.
Thank you so much, Paul.
Thank you, Robin.
And have a good sleep, I guess.
Well, I'm up for a bit longer. Okay. But okay. Good to speak to you.
Thank you so much.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye. That's Paul Gravett, and we just talked about comics. His new book, Best Crime Comics, Mammoth Book of, fun, wonderful collection of different types of good crime stuff, as well as a whole slew of other things. He... has been writing about comics and loving comics for years, and you should check him out.
Una mirada larga, buscando un poco de mi vida. Mis estrellas no responden para alumbrarme hacia tu risa. Olas que esfuman de mis ojos a una legión de tus recuerdos. Me roban formas de tu rostro, dejando arena en el silencio. Te busco perdida entre sueños. El ruido de la gente te envuelve en un velo. Te busco volando en el cielo. El viento te ha llevado como un pañuelo viejo. Y no hago más que rebuscar paisajes conocidos en lugares tan extraños que no puedo dar contigo. En cualquier huella te persigo. Una sombra te dibujo, huellas y sombras que se pierden
en la soledad.
La suerte no vino conmigo. Te busco perdida entre sueños. El ruido de la gente te envuelven en un velo. Te busco volando en el cielo. el viento te ha llevado como un pañuelo viejo. Y no hago más que rebuscar paisajes conocidos en lugares tan extraños que no puedo dar contigo. Te busco perdida entre sueños, el ruido de la gente te envuelve en un velo. Te busco volando en el cielo, el viento te ha llevado como un pañuelo viejo. Y no hago más que rebuscar paisajes conocidos en lugares tan extraños que no puedo dar contigo.